Well, happy Easter. There is no other holiday in the liturgical calendar that makes more of a challenge to Unitarian Universalists and other liberal clergy who aren't always sure just what to talk about. Garrison Keillor loves putting us down, putting us off, and giving us free publicity, and says that Unitarian Universalist congregational Easter celebrations are really botany lectures about the flowers and the birds and the bees and the springtime, and what a Unitarian Universalist won't do is talk about you know who. Him. Well, okay, that's fair enough. It is about spring. It is about rebirth. It is about renewal and new beginnings. There's a reason it's called Easter. The sun rises in the east. That's the new day. The journey of the Exodus was from west to east. The idea of continuous, ongoing renewal, second chances, third chances, fourth chances to engage life, to have as both reality and metaphor that sunrise. This is a time when we celebrate new life, being born in the spring, out of eggs. Eggs are in the middle of the Seder plate, and eggs somehow associated with bunny rabbits, there were some primitive biology back in the old days, is central to the whole idea of Easter. It's about fertility. It's about not only new life, but old life that's made new again. Think about the rhythms of nature. Not simply the sun and growing lower and seemingly colder as winter approaches. Not simply the days shortening, but all of the rhythms of seasons. And how they are reality, and they're also metaphors for the rhythms of the seasons of our own lives and our own hearts, from bright sunlight to dark despair. We feel all of those rhythms. And our faith is in a sunrise, in the return of life, in the return of warmth. The Psalms compare us to the grass. We grow in the morning, we flourish at noon, we wither in the afternoon, and then are cut down. And we get that connection. But then people make the next step, which is, but you know, the grass comes back in the springtime. That brown grass turns green again, and if the grass is going to come back, if those trees that lost their leaves that turned golden and red and then brown and then fell to the ground, those beautiful branches became twisted sticks, and then in the spring the flowers bud again, well, there's got to be something for us here. And so the idea of rebirth, of some form of resurrection, is in some ways a kind of natural theology. It's not simply that we cannot imagine a world without us, although that's certainly part of it. It is also the kind of intuitive sense that we have that there are rhythms to our lives. I have to tell you that as a clergyman, I have been privileged is the only right word, I think, to be with people at the end of the journey, when they close their eyes for the last time, when they breathe for the last time. And one of the things that I have always noticed was, one, the dog that didn't bark, and that was fear. If you're relatively healthy and you're sitting in here, you're scared to death of death. But when it approaches as part of something that is natural, while our friends and relatives and family may be weeping uncontrollably, most people welcome it and an end of pain and an end of suffering, and most people are not afraid, and most people have an instinct that it's not the end. And there's no relationship between somebody's theology and their instinct. I remember when the mother of my best friend was literally passing away, and I knew her theology to be hardcore atheist, believing in absolutely nothing is next. And yet her last words were, "Well, I'll put in a good word with the maitre d' on the other side for you boys." Now, it was a joke, and it wasn't a joke. There is this sense, whatever our beliefs, and that goes sometimes against our instincts. As I lay on the table in an emergency room many years ago in San Francisco, very sure that I was not dying, but that I was dead, because I had been ill and I had been shot with something that paralyzed me and I couldn't move and I couldn't breathe. What was absent was fear. I was not afraid. I could look down and see my body on the gurney, and I thought I could stand to lose 15 pounds. And I also said, this is really interesting because I'm dead now, and could all those religious people have been right? I'm floating up here above. I wonder how long consciousness lasts. It was curiosity. It wasn't fear. It was something that was indescribable. We have these instincts about going on and being part of something else, that it is not the end. And I'm not here to give you a definitive teaching on any of this, because I don't know, even with what happened to me. I don't know what's real, and I don't know what I believe, except that I believe in the spring. And I believe that what we do and what we choose and how we are with each other infuses this moment with meaning and infuses life with meaning. That the abstract issues of theology are not as important. I believe that we do spiritually endure, that the issues of physical resurrection, and incidentally, Orthodox Jews believe in physical resurrection. That's why if one has a limb amputated, that limb is buried. So on that great getting up morning, it's going to be there and you're not going to have to hop around paradise for eternity. In Isaiah it says, "My dust will arise and sing with your dust." Christians obviously believe in physical resurrection. Now I say that obviously, but it's not obvious. Both Jews and Christians and Muslims use words that can go either to the physical or to the spiritual. And because the idea of physical resurrection had a bunch of problems. Now, you know, rabbis and priests sat around, not together in the ancient days, more now, and wondered about, well, if you're going to be resurrected physically, how old are you going to be when you're resurrected? I mean, if you are lucky enough to live to Methuselah's age, do you really have to schlep around paradise with a 900-year-old body? And if you die in utero, do you really have to just kind of squirm around paradise? And what the rabbis decided was, it was, you got a body of either an 18-year-old or a 36-year-old. That's because, no, you, that was your own body. They didn't give you somebody else's body. You were reincarnated as 18 or at 36 because Chai, the number for life, is 18. Christians in general believe that you got a body of a 32-year-old or 33-year-old because that's how old Jesus was when he died. Ministers, priests, and rabbis, when they're not walking into bars, have fun talking about this kind of stuff. Maimonides said, look, having a body for eternity really sounds like a drag. The afterlife is spiritual. As it says in Ecclesiastes, the spirit of life goes back in the final breath to the God who gave it. And the rabbis said to Maimonides, Moshe, we've been telling people something different for a long time. Don't make us look bad here. And Moshe says, okay, you get a body for 1,000 years. And then you leave that body and you get a spiritual body. The truth is, however we understand it or we try to put it together, we have a sense that we go on. My old professor of Christian theology, an Episcopal priest named Ed Hobbs, Dr. Ed Hobbs, talked about how Jesus was alive today. And I said, so what do you mean by that? He said, well, whoever he was, whatever he did, still affects people, touches people, changes people, inspires people. Well, that's inarguably true. And that is a kind of continuation that all of us can hope for, that how we live our lives touch people in ways that we don't need to be remembered, we don't need to be famous in order to lead meaningful lives and have our lives send out ripples into the universe. Woody Allen was once asked if he was trying to achieve immortality through his work, and he said, no, I want to achieve immortality by not dying. And the bad news for Woody is, sorry, that's not going to work out so well for you. But the amazing effect that we have on one another, whether we are famous or not famous, is really quite remarkable. Now, I've known and met and occasionally even hung out with a number of famous people. I've known two famous Arnolds, Schoenberg and Schwarzenegger. I've known a couple of famous Crosbys, Bing and Dave. I have met and hung out a little bit with Mort Saul, with other people in the entertainment business, in the political business, and so forth. And all of those famous people left very little for me. The two that had a lasting influence was Dave Crosby, who I worked with, who taught me by example that I never wanted to speak and drink or do drugs at the same time, because it never makes you better. It may make you more relaxed, but it never makes you better. And that's something that I learned from him and that I have followed religiously. The only other famous person that made a dent in my life and psyche is Mort Saul, who taught me to see the absurdities in current events and in social mores, and to try to find that balance of laughter and pain, of insight and of revulsion, in order to engage the world and to use humor to pierce through the defenses that people have when we're dealing with politics, religion, society, and current events. Most of the important people in my life were not important to the world as far as the world knew. But they touched me, and they changed me, and I carry them, the living and dead, with me all of the time. There was Finley, who was a shoeshine man in Westwood, who introduced me to Socrates and to Spinoza and to a world of thought and of dialogue, who awakened in me an interest in philosophy. There was my speech and debate professor, Barry White.
No, not that Barry White.
Who said, wow, can you not sing, but you sure can talk. You ought to do something with that. And I carry Barry around with me all of the time. There was my old rabbi, Michael Roth, who I never realize how much I've stolen from until I go to a service and I hear him do one of our sermons. And I go, oh, did I get it from him or did he get it from me? No, I attend more of his services than he attends of mine, although I have spoken in his pulpit. And there's the single most influential non-family member in my life, who's Dr. Al Danzig, who was responsible for me coming to Southern California and getting Studio City as my church down here, and later, along with Jack Thiebert, responsible for me being here to a very large extent. And his kindness and confidence has played a huge role in my life, for better or worse. You can decide on your own. But that's my point. My point is, all of the people who touch our lives, all of the people that we carry around with us, when we think about it, and even when we don't think about it, they make a difference. My taste in music is influenced by my next door neighbor. My taste in books was influenced by my ear, nose, and throat doctor. My taste in cars was influenced by various people. All of these things, all of these relationships that we have, make life an incomplete information problem. We carry these people with us, family and non-family. People who have smiled at us, people who have cursed at us, people who have helped us when we were down, and people who pushed us down and we gained strength from getting back up again. We're not always sure who's doing us a favor and what's the blessing and what's the curse. But what we do know is that every life is a pebble thrown in a still pond, sending out ripples that touch many people and bump up against unknown shores. So that when we act, when we smile, when we embrace, when we open ourselves up to touch and to truth, to pain and to joy, it is an act of trust and of mutual creation. That's part of what we celebrate at Easter and in the springtime. The other part is a clergyman that I have always said at a funeral or memorial service, that when we come together to mourn the deaths and celebrate the lives of the people who have been important to us, those people are not in a coffin. They're not in an urn. We do not keep them on our fireplaces, nor do they live in cemeteries, nor do they live where they may be scattered in a park or on the sea. They live in us. They live in our memories. They live even when we don't remember and we do something that they taught us to do or inspired us to do. That is the ultimate good news of the metaphor of Easter. The good news is very simple. The tomb is empty. The tomb is empty. Jesus is not in any tomb, not in any holy sepulcher, resurrection or no resurrection. My Father is not at Hillside. I am not going to be spending eternity at Sinai in Simi Valley. We spend our lives now. We spend our futures in unknown dimensions as the ramifications of our lives play out in unexpected and often wonderful ways. Part of our tradition over a number of years is at Easter, we remember people whom we have lost during the previous year. So I would like to just move from one side of the congregation to another, and if there is somebody who has been important to you, who you want to carry with you lovingly from this moment through the course of your life, whom you've lost this year, please just speak that name as we go across. Star Bobby's Hill. Our grief is according to our blessing, and tears are the tender tribute of yearning affection for those people who have blessed our lives and are too precious to let go. At Easter, we remember with joy and with tears as we move them from in front of our eyes to a gentle place within our hearts, there to keep them alive and warm.